Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and I am here once again with my wonderful mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And how are you today on this beautiful day? Sunshine,
yeah, after our big windstorm. We had, some people are getting the big winds today. So, yeah. Anyway, it's December. It's Iowa. So
yeah, right.
It could be
snowy, you know.
It could be, but tornadoes are weird in December. That's just weird. And, you know, we really, our hearts go out to the people in Kentucky and Illinois and other places that were hurt.
I just can't imagine.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to imagine what our author today has had to deal with, too, isn't it?
That's for sure.
Who are we talking today to today?
Well, today we're talking to Jeffrey Morse, who is the author of Finding Forward. And you have the will within. That's the title of his book. And he had traveled the world. He had visited exotic locations, been a sports driver, and built successful careers in both military and in commercial aviation. And then one day, he suffered a brain aneurysm, a dissected artery, and a paralysis causing spinal cord stroke. So he found himself unable to do anything, but he was determined he was going to walk out of that hospital. So let's find out how he accomplished that.
Welcome to Writer's Voices, Jeffrey.
Thank you for having me, ladies. It's a pleasure to be here with both of you.
And where are you calling us from today?
Mooresville, North Carolina, which is about 25 miles north of Charlotte, North Carolina.
Okay. And is that kind of your hometown?
Yeah.
For a while.
Yeah.
Because I know you write about Charlotte in your book, Finding Forward, You Have the Will Within. So tell us a little bit about why you wanted to write this book.
Oh, that's a very good question. When I woke up paralyzed from my life-saving surgery, I found that I was paralyzed and paralyzed from the neck down. And I initially sat there in shock, but then another part of me kicked in and I started thinking to myself, wow, there's no instruction book for what I'm supposed to do now that I'm paralyzed. What's first? What's second? What's third? And thankfully, my brain went to a good place and thought, you know what, if you're able to one day, or when you are able, you ought to write about this and talk to everybody about what you went through, and maybe that would help them with what they're going through. So I made that goal on that day, and I wanted to keep my mind in positive places despite all of the trauma and devastation I was currently finding myself in.
Now, there's a lot of kind of miraculous healing that occurs during the course of this story, and yet it was a little unclear to me. What is your current status in terms of this disability?
Sure. So I'm still recovering. I still have weakness in walking. From time to time, I still use a cane when I walk. There are times when I can go out and go for a short walk and enjoy myself without the cane. But if I'm going for a longer walk, I'll bring a walking stick or cane with me as I'm walking. I still have diminished feeling in my legs and arms. And again, the weakness that I have. So I'm still working through this. It wasn't a blink your eyes recovery type of thing. This has gone on for 9 years. I still battle things like fascia, which occurs in my body and needs to be broken down through neuromuscular massage therapy. And I've got to continually work to improve myself. And thankfully, that occurs every year.
Wow. But you're not you wouldn't consider yourself paralyzed at this point.
No, yeah. No, I'm not paralyzed. I still have some of the lingering effects of it as far as feeling. And one of the other things that is slowly going away is my reduced proprioception, or my awareness of where I am in space. I still have a little bit of that, say, in my right arm. If I close my eyes, I don't know where my right arm is. So there's diminished effects of lack of proprioception in my legs. If I'm laying down at night in bed and the covers are over my legs, every now and then I get a little confused with where my legs are if say, I'm laying on my side. So there's still some of that going on, those lingering effects from the paralysis.
I'm sure that when you first woke up and you had that really severely, that it was terribly frightening. Is it still frightening when you have those feelings now, or those lack of feelings?
Well, I'm able to put it in check now. In the beginning, when you wake up paralyzed, the first thing that wants to come and be friends with you is claustrophobia, and it's through the roof, claustrophobia. You've gone from your independence to no independence instantaneously. You can think about what you would like to move in your body, and you have memories of that because you were just doing it a short time ago, and now all of a sudden it's all gone. For me, suddenly I'm paralyzed from the neck down. I can't feel anything from the neck down. But I didn't want to panic about that. What I wanted to do was put my mind in a good place and think about, hey, what do I have that still works? And everything from my neck up still did. I could talk, I could see, I could hear, I could think, I could breathe. Breathing was difficult because my diaphragm was affected by it, but I could do all those things. And despite it being difficult to breathe, I still had a mind to think with. Now all I needed to do was start finding what to do first.
Wow. I mean, I think for most people, we think of being paralyzed as something that you can't fix, that there's no way to change it, to heal it.
Yeah, it depends on what type of paralysis you're talking about. If we're talking about a break in the spinal cord, that type of spinal cord injury, yes, that would be extremely difficult to come back from that. While mm-hmm. the doctor found an aneurysm on one of my arteries on the right side of my neck, just below the base of my skull, they were working right next to my spinal cord. And while they were trying to save my life with this surgery to fix an aneurysm and a dissection in the artery above the aneurysm, they were causing stress or trauma in that area, which caused the stroke on my spinal cord. Spinal mm-hmm. cord strokes are very, very rare compared to a stroke on your brain. I shouldn't have survived the surgery, but I did, and thank God I did. And now I've been dealt these cards, and now it's time to get busy and figure out what's next. I was a question mark for quite a long period of time, whether I would survive from minute to minute or day to day. That was all a question mark. So I was literally living from one breath to the next, not knowing what would come in my future. And movement was obviously a question mark as well. So when the doctor came to visit me in recovery, he was telling me about the success of the surgery, but obviously it appeared that a stroke occurred wow. and from the neck down, and he told me I would more than likely never walk again. And I told him that wasn't good enough. You're not in my body. So that's up for me to determine, not you. And I equally told him in that same sentence, I'll walk out of this hospital one way or another.
Yep.
And you did.
And you did.
Yeah. You know, compared to a normal person, it would have looked ugly. But for me, every step was just beautiful thing in the world.
Oh, I'm sure. Were you able to write? You couldn't write when you first.
No.
So
no.
how did you remember all these details? I mean, this is amazing that you can remember all these in your journey, because it was, you know, minute by minute in some cases.
Well, so I've always had a good memory throughout my life. So as time went on, you know, all I have to do now, my job at this point, laying in a hospital bed, is trying to figure out how to make something move. And it's extremely frustrating when you're sending those signals from your brain to an empty vessel. So all of a sudden, days later, I was able to get a toe to twitch. I was able to get a finger to move ever so slightly, my thumb. And the next thing I know, I've got a cell phone being wedged up against me. And I thought, well, if you can wedge the phone up near my thumb, maybe I can start figuring out how to type. The problem then was I'm right-handed, and that right side of my body wasn't moving yet. I could move my left thumb, and I could move it enough to slowly type letters, but it was a slow process. And over time, I was able to move a little bit more, and although holding, say, my cell phone to type was difficult. I can't hold the phone, but I need to type something. So as time went on, I just kept journaling when I could. When I got to that point to be able to do it, I journaled as many times a day as I could to remember and recall all of these things that happened.
Had you had a practice of journaling before this accident?
No, you know, my aviation career, the type of writing that I did, technical writing, I could remember things in my brain and remember them with great detail, because when you are in an aviation type of setting as a career, you have to think very technically, and you need to be able to communicate without ambiguity to others. So in thinking in that manner, it was easy for me to remember, recall, put all these details down in great detail as I was doing that. So years later, when I would finally get to a point where maybe I could start typing, I could start putting a manuscript together. And that took a little over 4 years to do that.
Mm-hmm.
From when you started writing until it was complete?
No. Yeah. I started writing the book in March of 2017. It took me 5 months to write it on my laptop, and I could only do it left-handed. I typed the entire manuscript for the book with only my left hand. So, but once again, I'm just a driven and determined person. So I had all of the journaled notes up to that point, and it was very easy to put the manuscript together for the book.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know how you could do that. I really don't. It's amazing. It is. It. Oh, the thing that you said when you closed your eyes, then you couldn't see your body then, and it was, and you know, when we close our eyes, we're and you do now too probably, it's to rest, you know, but you couldn't rest because you had that, you were lost, and that must have been a horrible feeling.
It is. It's extremely horrible because you don't exist like regular humans anymore. So mm-hmm. you know, when you close your eyes, even though your eyes are closed, you have a subconscious recall of where your body is in space all the time. You mm-hmm. aren't thinking, but you are checking to see that my arms are there, my legs are there. This is the position of the arms and the legs, and you're doing it while you're sleeping and even while you're awake, and you never realize it. When you lose that ability, it becomes very distressful. And if I were to give you an example of that, how many times in your life have you woken up from a deep sleep because maybe you were sleeping on your arm wrong and your arm went to sleep? And it's distressing enough that it wakes you out of a sound sleep because your brain no longer has a connection with that arm or leg. And it's distressing enough that it not only wakes you up, but it wakes you up to the extent that now you're sitting up and maybe you turn a light on so you can see that, yeah, it's still there. It exists. I just can't feel it because the blood isn't running through it. So the next thing that you do is you start shaking that appendage to get the blood flow back into it. You get pins and needles. The pins and needles hurt. And you keep moving that appendage furiously until you've got that brain connection with it all over again. And then you can lay back down and calm your brain back down. Now imagine that same thing, only now it's over your entire body, and you can't shake your body. You can't talk to your body. You've got pins and needles, like you can't imagine, but you can't feel your body. It's just not there. So, you know, you can think about shaking it, but that's paralysis. There's paralysis for you. If you want to know what that feels like, there it is. And every time somebody pulls a sheet up over your body, you cease to exist beyond that sheet. So you can't ever have sheets on you. You need to be able to see your body the entire time. You need to be able to look down and see your toes. And when you can't, the claustrophobia jumps in full volume. And there's no in between. It's either not there or it's all there. So, yeah, anytime I closed my eyes, my body would disappear. And it would be so distressing that I couldn't sleep. So they would have to give me sleeping pills to knock me out, to force me to sleep. And when I would start coming back to consciousness, suddenly I would realize my body's not there. And when I would try to move, well, I couldn't do that either, and there's the claustrophobia back all over again.
Wow. So the interesting thing to me was it seemed like – so you had this stroke in your spinal cord, and it doesn't actually damage the muscles, but it damages the ability for your brain to communicate with the muscles. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so, and the way that you were able to overcome that was by actually looking at what you were trying to move. And why did that work?
So that didn't all happen right away. You know, at the end of the first week, they finally took me down to the physical therapy gym on a Saturday, and they wanted to assess, you know, where is my body at this point? Thankfully, prior to all this happening, I was very physically fit. I worked out in the gym. I did a lot of cardio, scuba diving, you name it. So from that aspect, my muscles were in good shape. So they took me down to the gym, and the physical therapy supervisor wrapped a belt around me and pulled me up out of the chair into a standing position. And she's holding me in this position. And one of the first things I realized was, okay, so my body's vertical. And wow, this feels good again to be in this position instead of horizontal. But I, you know, suddenly I'm, you know, facing reality. Okay, I feel like I'm standing on a cloud, if you will. And I have no right to use that word feel because it doesn't exist in my vocabulary or in my body anymore. But I'm vertical and I must be standing on these feet. And while I was realizing that, I suddenly realized, okay, stop thinking the way you used to think, where you had to know that your feet were touching the floor. So just throw that out of your brain right now. She's got you standing on something. And they must be working or you wouldn't be in this position. So at that point, I realized I needed to start taking some big leaps of faith and opening my mind objectively to what was going on And the next thing that hit me was I needed two words to never enter my brain. And those two words were, I can't. So I wasn't going to let that in either. And as they began working with me, I just had to let go. When they would move my legs around and I started getting the concept of awareness, if you will, and that was only at the deep tissue layers inside my legs, it felt like the therapist was moving around 200-pound blocks of cement. I had no sense of hot or cold. I had no sense of pain. I had no sense of fatigue. All that's gone. My only ability to know what the temperature was in the room was through my left nostril when I inhaled. That was my only ability to say, oh, it seems like it's cool in the room or it's warm. That was my only ability there to sense temperature.
And this can be dangerous if you can't tell whether it's too hot or too cold.
Absolutely. Imagine going outside and it's snowing sideways outside. It's 20 degrees and you're out in tennis shoes and shorts and a t-shirt and it feels like 72 degrees to you, but it's not. Or imagine the opposite. It's 100 degrees outside, but in your brain, it's 72 all over again.
And you actually had a pretty close call as a result of not being able to feel temperature.
Yeah, I had a diving incident. I went to go diving with some friends of mine one January a number of years back, and they got me into my gear. They knew I couldn't get into my gear on my own. They got me into my dry suit. They strapped my tanks on me and got me underwater. And me and another friend were moving around underwater. The water temperature was probably 45 degrees. And he was getting a leak in the neck seal of his suit, and he wanted to go back. I didn't realize the entire time of this 45-minute dive we were on that my suit was leaking water into it the entire time. So when we got back to shore and he went and got rid of his gear and came down to help me with mine, suddenly I realized something was wrong, and I could feel pain around my heart like somebody was beating on it with a hammer. And I knew what that was because I've had hypothermia in the past. I've had it in survival school, in the Air Force, and I've had it on one other occasion diving. So I thought, uh-oh, I probably have water in my suit. And lo and behold, I did. When they got my gloves off, I could see my fingernails were blue. I had cyanosis. I asked them if my lips were blue. They said yes. And yeah, I dodged a big bullet. I could have died right there that day from hypothermia. And it told me, you got to stop doing this. For the time being, you don't need to throw caution to the wind. So
when I was reading about your going diving after the accident, and you went the first time, you went pretty soon afterwards before you had anywhere near full control of your body.
Yeah.
And I would think that would be absolutely terrifying.
Well, up to that point, I'd been diving for almost 40 years. So I was used to being in the water, being underwater, being in water where I had 6 inches of visibility in front of my mask, and navigating through that. I was very comfortable in the water. So I kept saying to them, guys, I need to get back in the water. And they got me geared up one night and got me underwater. I was, again, barely moving. So they caught me down. I was down 35 feet. It was a shallow dive. And, and it's dark. And I could just barely kick my left foot fin with my left foot. So they let me go, and I'm moving along. I've got them above me, to the left and right of me, and everybody's having a good time. And suddenly I realized something's wrong and I'm headed down, and I'm kind of like that fighter airplane, World War II fighter airplane that just got shot down. I'm heading
Whoa.
To the bottom very quickly, and I crash into the bottom so hard, the silt on the bottom just exploded. So suddenly, where we had visibility, it went to absolute zero, and I could hear them panicking, looking for me. And it was so funny. All I could do was laugh, and I couldn't stop laughing. And all of a sudden, I could hear them laughing while they're trying to find me down on the bottom. And, you know, seconds, I could see light beams from flashlights getting close to me. And all I could do was laugh about it. You know, I'm enjoying life. I'm getting to do something, even though I'm still, you know, mostly paralyzed. I'm doing something that I used to do that I was always very comfortable with. So I could do nothing but laugh about it. And, you know, where's my fuel? Being positive, giving back. Those are the things that always help propel me forward. And that night, that was propelling me forward.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Jeffrey Morse, author of Finding Forward, You Have the Will Within. Jeffrey, would you like to read a little bit from your story?
Sure, I can, yeah.
That'd be great.
What would you like me to
read? Oh, I don't know. Do you have a favorite part?
Yes, I've got a number of favorite parts, and I don't actually have to read from it because I remember it so well.
I'll bet.
So, you know, 4 years into this journey, by now I was seeing a neuromuscular therapist, and she was helping me move forward by leaps and bounds at this point. And she was reducing my pain scale immensely, which was just spectacular. But I still had my highs and lows. And on one of the days of those lows, this was in June of 2016, she could see what was going on, and she knew that she needed to gain my trust so I could figure out how to let go. And on this one particular day, she looked at me as we were going into session, and she said, "Jeffrey, you survived. And I don't know if you ever think about that, but you survived. And you need to start telling yourself you're okay." And that was the most profound moment in my life. In everything I've done all over the world, that was by far the most profound moment. Because up to that point, over the last 4 years, nobody had ever said words like that to me. "You're okay. Tell yourself you're okay." And when she said that, she said, "I'm serious. I want to hear that come out of you." And I couldn't conjure those words. It was so difficult to just even think about it. And she finally pulled it out of me, and I couldn't believe the relief that I felt from that. I was finally letting go, and I was now understanding what it meant to let go. So I went through a very difficult time coming off medication during that period of time, detoxing off of it. My life's getting better. And all of a sudden, 3 months later, I decide, you know what, with all this therapy that I'm doing to find my way back, it's time for a vacation. And I decided I was going to go to Nepal. And on one day while I was over there in December of the same year, I was invited to go meet a lama. The manager of the hotel I was staying at wanted me to meet his lama guru, his Rinpoche. And
why don't you read? I'd like you to read that part. It's on page 204 of your book.
Page 204?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, let's see. So it starts with, later that afternoon, I met Dipendra at the hotel, and we headed over to the monastery. He brought four bags of fruit and flowers that were to be gifts for all the monks. When we arrived, we had leisurely climbed up to the entrance, and upon entering, I noticed incense burning on the grounds in front of the monastery. I sensed a ceremony for worshipers underway and could hear Dharma horns being played inside. The Pender took me around to the left side of the building, and we climbed the stairs to the top floor. We then took off our shoes and made our way into the Rinpoche's chamber. After I was introduced to him, the Rinpoche explained with the Pender as interpreter that a puja, a special ceremony, was going to be performed to remove obstacles in my life that were hindering my ability to heal. Because it was difficult at that time for me to kneel and sit on my legs with my knees bent, I was offered a chair facing the Rinpoche. He began the ceremony reading Sanskrit and speaking the mantra in a language known only to the lamas. The puja went on for about 30 minutes, and at the end, the Rinpoche asked me to approach him as he poured water over my bowed head. He then prayed over a protection string before affixing it around my neck. The Pender then took me over to the altar to light candles. When the ceremony was finished, I thanked the Rinpoche, and we sat and talked while the Pender played interpreter. As we were enjoying hot tea and rice cookies, the Rinpoche asked what happened to me, and I briefly told my story, to which he asked what brought me to Nepal. My simple answer was that I felt like it was a calling and where I needed to be, but I didn't understand why. I told him that I wanted to embark on a journey in my new life, as I didn't feel a connection with the old me any longer. Yet I was still in pain, and as a result, I was hoping to find peace and enlightenment while there on my trip. He asked if I meditated, and I told him yes. The next thing he told me sent shivers up my spine, and it was at that moment I will never forget for the rest of my life. He stopped speaking in Tibetan, and as he looked directly into my eyes, he said in English, "You must start telling yourself each time you meditate that you're okay. You must say, I am okay. Do you understand?" I said, "Yes." He then said, "I don't think I'm the first person to tell you this, am I?" I could barely breathe as he spoke these words to me, and for a few brief moments, I was frozen and shocked by what he said. Those were the exact words Jackie spoke to me only 4 months earlier, and now, a half a world away, the Rinpoche was telling me the exact same thing, word for word. All I could think was, how could I even begin to rationalize this moment? I told him I would, from now on, speak those words to myself every time I meditated. He then told me I had a strong, compassionate heart, and he could see me living well into my 80s. "I will live into my 100s," I said, and he laughed. We then took a few pictures with the Rinpoche and then said our goodbyes. I thanked the Pender for his kindness and for giving me the opportunity of such a memorable day.
So this was on your trip to Nepal, and this was Jeffrey Morse reading from Finding Forward, You Have the Will Within. What were some of the other highlights of that trip?
Well, the one that I always fall back on and think of the most is, so the first week was in a town called Pokhara. This is where I met the Rinpoche. The second week, I was back in Kathmandu, and on my first day in Kathmandu, I chartered a helicopter to take me to Mount Everest, and we went there. We landed at a plateau at 18,500 feet, and I wanted to get out of the helicopter and stare at Mount Everest and tell the tallest mountain in the world, "I don't need to climb any more mountains." The other I wanted to go was to stare at that mountain and say every therapist name aloud that helped me get to that point. That those two things were very important to me. And that moment standing there saying each of their names was one of the best moments of my life. Hours later, though, So we've left the plateau. We'd gone to another monastery, and I was blessed by another lama. Then we went off for champagne breakfast at a restaurant or a hotel at 13,000 feet with a restaurant on their back deck. And I asked perfect strangers to join me in a champagne toast. And I always remember this wonderful Japanese lady saying to me, "What are we toasting?" And I said, "Life." And she got all giggly and said, "Oh, great, I'm in." So when we left there, we went back to an airport called Lukla Airport. It's the most dangerous airport in the world. We, on our way from Kathmandu, we stopped there, dropped off extra fuel. And on our way back, we had to stop there to refuel the helicopter with that gas so we could get back to Kathmandu. While the pilot was doing that, a Sherpa helped me up some cement steps up into their village. And I spent a little time looking around, talking to people, buying gifts for friends back home. And on the walk back to the helicopter, the Sherpa was helping me down the steps. And as I looked ahead, I could see a lady trying desperately to talk to the helicopter pilot. She was crying, bawling her eyes out, and she was speaking in the local language of Nuwari. And I asked the Sherpa what was wrong with the lady. And this was on a Friday. So he said 2 days earlier, her husband was in a really bad accident. And if I recall, it was up near Everest Base Camp. And they had to life flight him to Kathmandu. And here, 2 days later, she's finding out that her husband passed away. And she was trying to ask the pilot for a ride. Walking, it probably would have taken a month through all the mountainous terrain. But I asked the Sherpa if he could take me around to the other side of the helicopter where the pilot was. And he said, yes. When I got over there, I told the pilot, "Hey, this is my charter today, and we've got room. We're going to take this lady with us back to Kathmandu so we can get her to the hospital to go get to her husband, her deceased husband." So we got her on the helicopter, and for the next 45 minutes, she was crying. I couldn't understand a word she was saying. My guide and his wife were in the back seat with her. And when we got to Kathmandu, we got her in a cab and off to the hospital. And when my guide and his wife were taking me back to my hotel, I was asking what she was saying. And they said, "Jeffrey, the whole time we were with her in the back seat, she kept asking us to thank you for bringing her with us." And I was just so moved by that. And the reason I was moved by it was I got to help another human being again. And I hadn't been able to do things like that since all of this happened with the paralysis and the stroke and the aneurysm. And it just warmed my heart more than I could begin to tell anybody. A couple days later, the night before I was going to leave to go back home, I took my guide and his wife out to dinner to a traditional Nepali restaurant. And they were asking, they said, "Jeffrey, you've been here 2 weeks, and that's longer than most come to our country. With all that you did, is there one thing that you enjoyed most?" And they said, "It's okay if it takes a while for you to answer that." And I said, "I don't need any time to answer that. I can answer that right now." I said, "You know, anybody can go on a vacation and do all kinds of thrill-seeking things like I did on this trip, and meet wonderful people. But how often do you get to help another human being?" I said, being able to help that lady and get her back to Kathmandu, that was the pinnacle of my trip, just being able to help another human being. And those are the little things that I was grasping on to say, your life is still worth something. You do have things to offer. Keep going with what you're doing, no matter where it takes you. Stay positive with what you're doing. And if you ever have the opportunity to help somebody, do so. And those were defining moments on that trip and in my life, and they still are to this day.
There's a very interesting picture on the cover of your book that's also from that trip, I believe.
Yeah, that was during my first week in Pokhara. One of the excursions I set up was to do something called parahawking. So
yeah.
We went up a 6,000-foot mountain, and I was put into a harness with a person flying a paraglider, and that gentleman is behind me in the picture. And they had to run alongside me since I couldn't run to get me down the side of the cliff and up to the edge, and then the paraglider takes over. And while we were up there, they had a Egyptian vulture, which is on the picture there, and they used the vulture to help them find the thermals in the air for lift. So there was our paraglider and one other. The other had a National Geographic photographer, and that's another story in itself. But the Egyptian vulture was going back and forth between our paragliders, and when it would come over to you, you'd have food in your gloved hand, and it would land on your hand, and you'd feed it, and then it would take off again. And we got to do that for about 20 to 30 minutes. And one of the things that was great about it for me was being up in the air again, and this time being up in the air, and there's no motors to listen to, there's no fuselage, there's no windows. It's just you looking out, and what's out there for me to stare at? The Himalayan mountains to the north.
Wow. We're,
you know, gliding to the west, and we came down along the side of the lake and landed along the shore there. And as soon as it was all over, I got whisked into town, jump on a bus, go back up to the top of the mountain to zip line for the very first time at 90 miles.
Oh, my God.
You're not a thrill seeker, are you?
not in a little bit, no.
I did zip lining in the jungles south of Cancun. That was a wonderful experience. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, yeah. It's just exhilarating having a breeze on your face like that and being able to look around and see and feel life again. Oh, God, you just can't put words to it.
Yeah, and I've never done paragliding, but I did do parasailing, you know, where they pull you behind a boat. And at the time, I thought, yeah. Oh, you know, if you fall in the water. But they said, no, it'd be like fall from that height. It would actually be like falling on cement. But I didn't know that before I went up.
I threw caution to the wind with it. And the pilot said at the end, when I tell you to pull your feet up because you're going to come in on your rear end. And I said, all right, let me know. So yeah, it was good.
Wow. Now you were a flight engineer and a flight instructor. Were you also a pilot?
So the flight engineer is kind of the third pilot, if you will. Have you ever gone onto an airplane years ago, and as you're entering the airplane and you look up in the flight deck there, you see the guy sitting sideways, but behind the two guys facing forward. And the guy sitting sideways is sitting there at a really big panel full of instruments. And the way I like to describe what a flight engineer does is, if there's any Trekkies out there, it's like being Scotty. You're the answer man. You know everything about the aircraft beyond the two guys driving. And if you ever had to drive, well, you could drive. But you're the guy that's keeping that thing airborne and healthy, and no matter what happens to it, that's your job. So you lose an engine, that's your job. Something electrical, hydraulic, fuel-related, whatever, that's your job. The airspeeds you need to do all the things you do to pull it off the ground or put it back on the ground, that's your job. So it was always invigorating to do a job like that. And later on, at my second airline, all of a sudden, one day, we're we're in the midst of doing contract training, or we have a contractor doing our training, and it's costing so much money. So I put together a report, a return on investment for the president and CEO of the company, and asked for 15 minutes one day, and went in and did my elevator speech. And he said, "Hey, great. When can you get started?" And I said, "Right now." And he said, "How long will it take you to put a training program together for the airline?" And I said, "Give me 4 months." And I did that. And all of a sudden, I find myself training. And the other thing that I find of it is, wow, this seems like a second calling to me. And I felt like I had more to give back teaching than I did out there flying. And at that point, I'd been flying all over the world for years. So the idea of standing in a classroom actually felt nice. And I was good at it. I was a natural at it. And it always felt good to give back. And, you know, there again, that's the type of person I am. That's my in my DNA. And I always felt good doing it. And after the stroke and the paralysis, 3 years after it all happened, I had some old airline buddies call me one day and say, "Hey, we've got a we're in a startup airline. Can you come down and put a training department together for us?" And I said, "Well, let me tell you what's wrong with me. And if you guys decide you don't need me, well, I understand, and you're not hurting my feelings. But I said, you guys go talk amongst yourselves and get back to me." Well, that didn't take long. And they said, "Hey, we need you. All we care about is your brain. We don't care about your body. We got to throw you in a wheelchair. We'll throw you in a wheelchair. But we need you down here in Miami right now." So, you know, now all of a sudden, you know, I'm still not doing the walking thing very well. And now I'm going to Miami every month to work. And I had to figure that out. And then all of a sudden they're asking me, "Hey, how do you feel about getting back in the flight simulator and teaching in the flight simulator?" And I just threw caution to the wind with it, said, "You know, wherever you want to throw me, throw me. I'm working, I'm living with this disability, and I'm moving beyond it." So I was, you know, happy once again for these gifts. And it always seemed like God was sending me angels, and I wasn't going to turn my back on them.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Jeffrey Morse, author of Finding Forward, You Have the Will Within.
This one time when you were in the hospital and you were able to get to the therapy room yourself because of your left foot was still, were you able to use your left foot? But how did you do that? I wasn't sure. I didn't figure out how you did that.
For whatever reason, while they were working on me, they were trying to tap into where I did have awareness. And it took time, but we finally discovered that I had awareness at the deep tissue level. So if they were, say, tapping on my leg, I could sense the vibration. So if I could lock into vibration, upper leg, lower leg, foot, then I could tap in to talk to that or figure out how to talk to it. And that was how they got my left foot to be able to respond. The right foot was totally out of the picture. So we worked with that, and we got me to a point where sitting in a wheelchair, I could start figuring out how to pull that foot through to make the wheelchair go forward. The rest of me didn't work, though. At first, they had to get me in a wheelchair. Then they had to teach me how to transfer from the bed to the wheelchair. And that was something like sitting at the edge of the Grand Canyon and moving from one cliff face to the next on a...
No.
That was leap of faith all over again, and don't let I can't in. So once I was able to figure that stuff out and transfer the chair, you know, hey, here's a big win. I've got a little independence back. And when they gave me the go ahead to do that, man, that felt great to be able to go to therapy on my own, although I could only use the left leg. And while I was doing that, the wheelchair, the left leg of the wheelchair had a real sharp edge on it, and they had tape on it so you wouldn't come in contact with the sharp metal edge. And one day I was going down to therapy, and one of the things I always noticed in a wheelchair was people that are standing don't look at people in wheelchairs. And that was always bothering me. And I had to learn to get past that, and because nobody ever looked at me. And one day I'm making my way down to the physical therapy gym, and a doctor stops along a intersection in the hallways, and he says, "Oh my God, what happened?" And I suddenly noticed he's staring at me, and I thought, "Wow, that's unusual. I've actually got a human being, you know, giving me eye contact." And he said, "What happened?" And I said, "What are you talking about?" And he said, "There's blood on the floor." And I looked down to my right. I didn't see anything. I looked down to my left, and my left leg is bloody. The tape came off that sharp metal edge, and as I was pulling my leg through, I was cutting my leg very deeply. And I'm on blood thinners. So there's a trail of blood down the hallway that I just came from. And I couldn't feel any of that. There was no pain. There was just red stuff leaking out of my leg. So they had to fix that. And I thought, you know, that was one of the first times I realized, you know, you got to protect the vessel, and you've got to be cognizant of what little you can be cognizant of. You've got to be cognizant of everything going on around you. Be vigilant. Mm-hmm. That was a good lesson.
Wow. Well, Jeffrey, let's talk a little bit in the few minutes we have left about the writing and publishing of your book. You said you typed it with your left hand, but of course we all know typing a first draft is just the beginning. What was the next step, and how did you end up, you know, where we have this finished book in our hands?
Well, the first person I would bring up is my ghostwriter, Bonnie Hearn Hill, who helped me as a ghostwriter pull everything together, and I couldn't have done that without her. The second part of it with my publisher, I absolutely love my publisher. Everybody there at the publishing house is just absolutely spectacular, top-notch, and I couldn't have done this without them either. So they read the manuscript. They came right back to me and said, "Wow, we never heard people talk about so many things that you talk about in this book. It's just uncharted territory up to this point." And they, you know, they brought me on board, and the next piece of it was the editing process. Three different edits that you go through, three different versions. And lo and behold, one day earlier this year, suddenly we're talking about book covers, and then what we found on social media. And I wasn't somebody that was very up to speed with social media, so I was a novice there. And again, thank God for angels and, you know, all the people at the publishing company were just, you know, jumping at helping me through all of this. And, you know, once again, I'm so happy to be thanking people helping me, because I couldn't have done this without them. And I'm so grateful that all of a sudden now, you know, last week, the end of last week, I see a book for the very first time. And this week it's now out there on Amazon and Barnes and Noble and Walmart.
And that's Finding Forward, You Have the Will Within by Jeffrey Morse. And it's published by Brown Books Publishing Group, which is one of the older hybrid publishers. It was known as the first hybrid publisher and is named by Publishers Weekly as a top five fast-growing independent publishers 3 years in a row. So they must be doing a lot right there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I cannot say enough great things about them. Millie Brown, Tom Real, everybody. I'm so thankful to every one of them every single day.
And you're working with a great publicist who brings me a lot of wonderful authors for Writers' Voices. Yep. That's shout out to Leslie.
Yes, shout out to Leslie as well, and Cassidy of Brown Books.
Yeah.
I'm thankful to everybody. And the one thing I would say to people going through what I have been going through is always take time to thank your caregivers and thank your therapists. It's not an easy job for them to do what they're doing, and mm-hmm. they do it for the love of the job and helping somebody else. You know, take time as often as you can to stop and look them in the eyes and just stop everything going on and thank them sincerely for everything that they do for you.
That is really excellent advice. And congratulations on everything that you have accomplished since you faced something that, you know, none of us ever wish on anyone or would hope that no one would have to face, and overcoming so much. We're out of time, but So Mom,
can I say something?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. This is a direct quote by our author. Just because something happens that changes the course of your life does not mean it's over. You can alter your course, create a new path, and live a brand new life, the only requirement of which is opening yourself up to your own imagination. And that's what he did, for sure.
Wow. Well,
thank you.
Thank you, Jeffrey. And thank you, Caroline. And see you all next week on Writers' Voices. Thank you.